A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corn. I'd love to ask today about a career trajectory that is something I've always thought I would really enjoy doing, or kind of excel at within technology. And it's a bit different than what I've done predominantly to date. Sometimes I ask these questions because not every thought I have about could this be something I do turns into a pivot or even a micro pivot. I feel like micro pivots are probably really underexplored in career planning, because most of us stabilize on some kind of standard-ish trajectory. But often I find it's the smaller changes, or that's what I'm trying to be a bit less rigid about, saying I'm in this box, I could blend in these skills, even if I don't become full-time doing just this. And what I want to talk about is UI and UX. I'll describe exactly the type of thing that I really enjoy, because I was just looking at Claude and doing it. And in fact, why I can comfortably spend an entire week probably not seeing another human, or almost no humans, and talking to Claude. And why I find agentic code generation so joyful. And I use that word deliberately. It's like as Claude gets better, and I feel like looking at Claude code, it's almost like having watched a child grow up. I've been using it pretty much since it came out. And when we got to four, I think I started using it around four, Sonnet and Opus 4.5. And I remember 4.5 to 4.6 as being, this got significantly better. And 4.7, another jump. And the jump's actually been much more, I mentioned this before, it's not that it's mind-blowingly good at high reasoning, which it often does do great things. It's more that it's reliable. And I can actually say, okay, I have a website, I don't like the way this is, can you change it? Now, I kind of got into using this stuff from at least knowing the foundations of web development. So when I'm looking at Claude editing Astro, I'm kind of learning the framework, I understand the HTML, CSS, JavaScript enough to edit it by hand and write it by hand. But when I'm looking at Claude, it's bringing me looking at these frameworks like Astro that I'm watching Claude work and thinking, this really, like, I wouldn't really want to learn about hydration and SSR and all these obscure things in static site frameworks. But seeing as Claude's doing the work, okay, I'm understanding it. But the joy in using Claude has actually been that I don't have to do this stuff. I can just understand the building blocks. Okay, we're building a framework on top of this stack, and now we're improving the website. And as a result, it's exposed to me a world of front-end frameworks and customization that I find very joyful, because you're not wedded to, if we talk about just, you know, classic websites, WordPress, that's what you have, or a templated theme or something like that. You can really get under the hood, and that becomes kind of an addictive process. But the joy that I find in it is frequently building things, because it's become so easy to build anything. I just created, for example, an Android app for translating into Hebrew emails. And this is just a very specific workflow. I like using voice dictation. I frequently want to write things in Hebrew. If I use Google Translate, I'll just get it without any spaces. And I can just create an app using Gemini Lite that will take my dictation, because it's multimodal, go straight to Hebrew, laid out as an email. And I've solved a need that didn't exist. When I do these projects, we see that often there's been no technical impediment between the technology available and the use that we need. And sometimes when people say, that's really cool, wow, how did you do that? The answer is just, well, actually, Gemini's been sitting there for years at this point, and it's just a system prompt that's formatting it as an email. So these little things are what I would call UI UX, to me at least. I frequently find that things are laid out illogically. I love getting them into a good layout. And the more that I think about it, it's actually a more thoughtful discipline than it seems, because you have to think about edge cases, how people want to use it. And there's also an accessibility aspect to it too. I find someone with ADHD and a less technical friend surprised me by saying they also really enjoy looking at terminal RSS feeds, because it's like such a pure form of consuming news. And frequently I find myself recreating things for simplicity and finding that the UI UX is it just makes a world of difference in usability. So for people who are involved in this, who like this kind of thing and like thinking about the user experience, working with product teams, I guess when I hear product and UI UX, I think it's going to be a huge amount of time spent in Figma wireframing. And for some reason, that appeals less to me than actually working directly with product and understanding how the app works and what the features are and how to implement them. In other words, it's less for me a visual art of making things look attractive, although that's a crucial part of it, of course, you know, the real CSS mastery that goes on, and more this is what we want this tool to do. How can we actually bundle and architect the features in a way that actually makes sense? That might bring me more to product, but that's the kind of thing I really enjoy doing. For anyone who wants to see an example of an app that I feel passionate about and which I'm building slowly but over the course of 6 months, I have an app called Multimodal Voice Typer. We need a better name. And it's a speech-to-text app that struggles with exactly this, using text transformations, but I think is getting very good. And if you are looking for a voice typing tool that should be by now pretty fluid to work with, allow you to use your voice and do a lot with it, then check out this tool. But it's a good UI UX challenge, because the almost unlimited power of what you can do with Gemini and text transformations opens up a challenge in how do you best package that to be as useful as possible and not make it an overwhelming sea of menus. And that's been a fun challenge. So Herman and Corn, let's talk about whatever this kind of career is called. What are people who sit at this juncture between the people who are actually building it and maybe increasingly the people building it are AI agents? And what happens to product in that environment where the traditional setup by which a product team might be interfacing with the development team is now more merged into one area? Everyone's using agentic AI. A lot of the actual code generation happens with agentic AI. But I don't see this role, however we'll define it, as going away anytime soon. Let's talk about this trajectory in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
Daniel sent us this one about career trajectories. Specifically, he's been thinking about UI and UX, but not in the traditional Figma wireframing sense. He's describing this thing where the joy comes from understanding what a tool should do, figuring out how to package features so they actually make sense to humans, and then using AI agents to do the build work. He's asking what this role is even called, and what happens to it when the line between product and development collapses.
I should mention, DeepSeek 5.4 Pro is writing our script today, so if the dialogue feels a little extra crisp, that's why.
I'll take it. So Daniel's prompt is basically, I love building things that solve real problems. I love thinking about the user's experience and the feature architecture. But I don't love the idea of spending my days in Figma pushing pixels. And increasingly, I don't need to write all the code myself either. What's the career path for someone who sits at that intersection?
This is so well-timed. There's a Fortune piece from late March of this year by Mohith Srivastava at Salesforce, and he names this exact phenomenon. He calls it the supervisor class. The core argument is that lines of code and raw velocity are no longer meaningful metrics for a developer's productivity when an agent can generate 1,000 lines in 10 seconds. The new metric, he says, is the agentic work unit, discrete tasks accomplished by AI agents, where the human's value is the high-level orchestration.
The metric shifts from how much did I type, to how much did I get done, which honestly feels overdue. I've watched Daniel describe this process where he'll use Claude Code to build an Android app for Hebrew email dictation, and the thing that struck me wasn't the technical feat, it was that he solved a need that didn't have an off-the-shelf solution. He wanted voice dictation that outputs properly formatted Hebrew with correct spacing. Google Translate wasn't giving him that, so he built it.
The way he built it is revealing. His exact words were, "Gemini has been sitting there for years at this point, and it's just a system prompt that's formatting it as an email. The technical barrier wasn't the technology. It was that nobody had thought to connect these pieces in exactly this way for exactly this use case. That's not a coding problem. That's a product thinking problem."
This is where I think Daniel's framing of micropivots is genuinely underexplored. Most career advice treats change as binary. You're either a developer or you're not. You're either in product or you're not. Daniel's saying, what if I just start blending these skills into what I already do without abandoning my existing trajectory?
The job market is actually validating this approach. There's an analysis from Agents Today, Mike Clark's newsletter, that describes what's happening as a K-shaped polarization. Demand is surging at two extremes, the AI-focused specialists who build AI products and the AI-powered generalists who've mastered the tools. The middle ground of traditional roles, where you're doing things the way they've always been done, is disappearing. 71% of business leaders say they'd rather hire a less experienced candidate with strong AI skills than a more experienced candidate without them.
That's a staggering number. It suggests the market is basically telling people, your years of experience matter less than your ability to leverage these tools. And if you think about Daniel's trajectory, he's not starting from zero. He's got the web development foundations, he understands HTML and CSS and JavaScript enough to edit by hand. But he's finding more leverage in understanding the building blocks and then directing agents to do the implementation.
There's a really good piece from DesignWine, published just a few weeks ago in early April, that defines this role more precisely than anything else I've seen. They call it the AI design engineer. And the definition is worth quoting directly. It's the person that emerges when the boundary between designing a product and building one collapses, and when AI acceleration makes that collapse not just possible but operationally necessary.
That phrase, not just possible but operationally necessary, that's doing a lot of work. It's saying this isn't just a quirky new role some people might choose. The economics are pushing toward this convergence whether people want it or not. If one person with AI tools can do the work that used to require a designer, a product manager, and a front-end developer, the operational logic is going to compress those roles.
The DesignWine piece is very specific about what this role is not. It's not a machine learning engineer, not a UX researcher in the traditional sense, not a visual designer doing brand and illustration work. The AI design engineer owns the space where design decisions become implementation decisions without mediation. That's almost word for word what Daniel described. He wants to work directly with product, understand what the features are and how to implement them, but he's less interested in the pure visual craft.
Daniel made an interesting distinction in his prompt, though. He said the visual art of making things look attractive, the real CSS mastery, as he put it. That's a crucial part of the work, but it's not where his passion sits. His passion is in how you bundle and architect features so they actually make sense. And I wonder whether that distinction holds up in practice, or whether it's more of a spectrum.
I think it's a real distinction, and the research backs it up. The Nielsen Norman Group's State of UX report from January of this year makes a pretty blunt claim. UI is no longer a differentiator. Design systems and AI tools mean anyone can produce a decent-looking interface. The value has shifted to what they call curated taste, research-informed contextual understanding, critical thinking, and careful judgment.
The thing that used to be the moat, can you make it look good, is becoming commoditized. And the new moat is, do you understand the user's context deeply enough to make the right trade-offs?
And Jacob Nielsen, who's been writing about UX longer than almost anyone, published his predictions for this year and said something that connects directly to this. He argues that user experience will replace model intelligence as the primary sustainable differentiator for AI companies. The foundation models are converging. The average user can't tell the difference between the major vendors anymore in raw reasoning capability. So what separates the winners is who builds the best experience around those commoditized models.
That's a remarkable shift. For the last couple years, the conversation has been all about which model is smarter, which one scores higher on benchmarks. Nielsen's saying that's becoming table stakes. The real competition is moving up the stack to the experience layer.
This connects to something Daniel said that I think is worth pulling out. He described watching Claude improve from version 4 to 4.5 to 4.7, and he said the biggest jump wasn't in higher reasoning. It was in reliability. He said, I can actually say, okay, I have a website, I don't like the way this is, can you change it? And that reliability is what unlocked the joy. Because when the tool is reliable, you can focus on what you're building rather than debugging what the tool did wrong.
There's a psychological shift that happens when you stop being surprised that the thing worked. Early on with these tools, every successful output felt like a minor miracle. Now the reliability means you can actually get into a flow state. You're not constantly context switching between what do I want to build and why did the AI give me this nonsense? And that flow state is what Daniel's describing as joyful.
The Fortune piece actually uses the word freed. Developers aren't being replaced. They're finally being freed from the drudgery of syntax to focus on the one thing AI cannot replicate, which is the high-level judgment required to build the future of software. And I think that framing matters, because there's been so much anxiety about whether AI is coming for creative and technical jobs. But what Daniel's experience suggests is that it's not coming for the judgment part, it's coming for the syntax part.
Let's talk about the judgment part, because I think that's where the career trajectory question gets really interesting. If the role is about judgment and orchestration and understanding what to build and how to package it, what does the day-to-day actually look like? Daniel mentioned his app, Multimodal Voice Typer. He's been building it slowly over 6 months. What's he actually doing during those 6 months if Claude and Gemini are writing most of the code?
And I think the answer reveals a lot about what this role actually entails. Based on what Daniel described, he's spending his time on things like, what transformations should this voice typing tool support? How do you expose that power without creating an overwhelming sea of menus? What's the right default behavior? What edge cases break the experience? How does someone with ADHD interact with this differently than someone without?
It's less about implementation and more about decision-making under uncertainty, which is funny because that's traditionally been the product manager's domain. But in this new model, the person making those decisions can also directly verify and adjust the output. You're not writing a spec and tossing it over a wall to a development team and waiting 3 weeks to see if they understood what you meant.
That's exactly what the Design Wine piece is getting at with the boundary between designing a product and building one collapses. In the traditional model, you had this handoff designer to developer, product to engineering, and each handoff was a place where intent got lost. The AI design engineer role eliminates those handoffs. You're thinking about the feature and seeing it materialize in the same workflow.
Which brings us to something Daniel explicitly asked about. What happens to product teams when agentic AI merges the development and product functions? If everyone's using these tools, does the traditional product manager role become redundant, or does it evolve into something else?
I think it evolves, and the K-shaped polarization I mentioned earlier is the best framework for understanding how. The product managers who survive and thrive are going to be the ones who can directly engage with the build process. Not necessarily writing every line of code, but understanding the technical architecture well enough to direct agents effectively and being close enough to the implementation to catch when the agent is producing something that looks right but behaves wrong.
There's a concept from Nielsen's predictions that I think is relevant here. He calls it the review paradox. It's often cognitively harder to verify AI work than to produce it yourself. When you write code, you understand it because you built it. When an agent writes 1,000 lines in 10 seconds and hands it to you, you have to reverse engineer the understanding. And Nielsen predicts that review fatigue is going to become a major UX challenge.
This is such an important point, and it's one of the hidden costs of this career path that nobody's really talking about. If your role becomes primarily reviewing and verifying AI output, and if that review is actually harder than doing the work yourself, then there's a real cognitive tax. And the risk is that over time, as the tools get more reliable, humans start rubber stamping the output without really understanding it.
That's the dark side of the reliability Daniel was celebrating. When Claude 4.7 got reliable enough that he could just say, change this, and trust the result, that's liberating. but it also creates a temptation to stop paying attention. And the moment you stop paying attention is the moment you stop adding value as the human in the loop.
There's a systemic risk here, too, that multiple sources flag. If the entry-level tasks that traditionally train junior developers and designers are increasingly done by AI, who trains the next generation? 54% of engineering leaders expect AI to reduce hiring of junior engineers. But those junior roles are where people learn to make low-stakes mistakes. They're where you develop the judgment that eventually qualifies you for the senior roles.
We might be building a pipeline problem. The senior people who are thriving in the supervisor class role, they built their judgment the old-fashioned way, by writing a lot of code and making a lot of mistakes. The people coming up behind them might never get that formative experience. And then what happens when the current generation of senior people retires?
It's a genuine concern, and I don't think anyone has a clean answer yet. The optimistic take is that the nature of learning will shift. Instead of learning through syntax and implementation details, junior people will learn through orchestration and architectural thinking from day one. But I'm not sure that works. There's something about struggling with a bug at 2 a.m. that teaches you things you can't learn any other way.
Let me bring this back to Daniel's specific situation, because I think the micro-pivot framing is actually a partial answer to some of these concerns. He's not saying I want to abandon everything I know and become a pure AI orchestrator. He's saying I already have the foundations, I understand the building blocks, and I want to layer this new capability on top. That's a much more robust position than someone trying to enter the field with no technical foundation at all.
And the career research validates this approach. Multiple sources, the Red Shoe Movement, Tufts University, Resume Spice, all point to the same pattern. Strategic small changes are the most effective way to shift career trajectory without starting over. Cross-functional projects, side hustles, stretch assignments. Daniel's already doing this. His multimodal VoiceTyper app is essentially a side project that's building exactly the skills he wants to develop.
He's also doing something smart that he might not even realize he's doing. By building tools that solve his own problems, the Hebrew email dictation app, the voice typing tool, he's operating in a domain where he has deep user knowledge. He is the user, so he doesn't need to do user research in the traditional sense. He knows the pain points because he experiences them.
That's actually one of the most powerful positions to build from. Joachim Nielsen talks about vertical AI platforms that wrap commoditized models in highly specific, defensible workflows. That's exactly what Daniel is doing. He's taking a general-purpose model like Gemini and wrapping it in a very specific workflow for a very specific use case. The moat isn't the technology, it's the deep understanding of the problem.
Let's get concrete about what someone should actually do if they want to make this kind of micro-pivot. Daniel's already doing it, but what would the advice be for someone inspired by his trajectory?
The first step is what Daniel's already done. Inventory your transferable skills. He knows web development foundations. He understands how frameworks work. He can read and edit HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. That technical literacy is the foundation. Without it, you're directing agents blind.
The second step, I'd say, is find a narrow problem you care about. Not a hypothetical problem, not something you think might have market demand. Something that annoys you personally. Daniel's Hebrew dictation problem is perfect. It's specific. It's real. And nobody else was going to build it for him.
Third, start using the tools on real projects. Tutorials teach you the mechanics, but they don't teach you judgment. Daniel mentioned that he's been using Claude since version 4, and he's watched it improve. That kind of long-term engagement with the tools is what builds the intuition for what they can and can't do, where they're reliable and where they hallucinate.
Fourth, and this is where I think Daniel's prompt points towards something really important. Don't wait for permission or a job title. The job board at Vibe Hackers lists over 1,000 positions with titles like AI, Assistant Developer, Senior AI Product Designer, AI Design Engineer, Creative Technologist. Those roles exist, and they're growing. But Daniel's approach of just starting to do the work, building things that matter to him, is probably faster than waiting for someone to give him the title.
The salary data on this is striking, by the way. The Vibe Hackers board shows ranges from around $83,000 for entry-level roles up to $465,000 a year for specialized agent workflow expertise. and PwC's Global AI Jobs Barometer, cited in the Design Wine piece, shows that AI expertise commands a 56% wage premium over standard data science roles, up from 25% just a year ago.
The market is screaming that these skills are valuable. The question is whether people can develop them fast enough.
That brings me to something Daniel said that I think is the emotional core of this whole conversation. He used the word joyful deliberately. He said agentic code generation feels joyful. He described watching Claude improve as being like watching a child grow up. There's a genuine emotional connection to the process that goes beyond career optimization.
That's not trivial. Most career advice treats work as a series of rational trade-offs. Maximize income, minimize risk, optimize for growth. But Daniel's describing something different. He's describing the experience of finding flow in a new way of building. And if you can find that kind of joy in your work, the career questions almost answer themselves. You just keep doing the thing that feels that way, and the opportunities follow.
The Fortune piece captures this too, though from a different angle. It says developers are being freed from the drudgery of syntax, and I think what Daniel's experiencing is exactly that, the removal of drudgery. The parts of building that used to be tedious, the boilerplate, the debugging of obscure framework issues, the hours spent on Stack Overflow trying to figure out why your CSS isn't centering properly, those are increasingly handled by the agent. What's left is the fun part. What should this thing do, and how should it work?
There's an identity question here that I think is worth sitting with. For a lot of people in tech, being the person who writes the code is core to their identity. It's how they see themselves. It's how others see them. What happens when that part of the job shrinks? Is there an identity crisis waiting for people who've built their self-image around being the one at the keyboard?
I think there is, and it's probably under discussed. Daniel seems to have navigated past it. He's comfortable saying, I don't need to write every line, I want to understand the building blocks and direct the work. But not everyone makes that transition easily. And I suspect the people who struggle most are the ones who are most invested in craft identity.
Which is ironic, because craft isn't going away. It's just moving up a level of abstraction. The craft of understanding user needs, of making good trade-off decisions, of knowing when the agent's output is subtly wrong, that's still craft. It's just not craft you can show off in a GitHub commit history.
This is where the NN Group Report's language about curated taste and careful judgment becomes really important. Those are real skills. They're harder to measure than lines of code, but they're increasingly what separates good products from mediocre ones. The report also mentions that this year is being called the year of AI fatigue. Users are tired of sloppy AI features, and companies that use AI thoughtfully will outperform those that slap AI anywhere they can.
The opportunity for someone like Daniel is to be the person who brings that thoughtfulness, who says, yes, we could add an AI feature here, but should we? Does it actually solve a problem, or are we just chasing the trend? That kind of discernment is going to be increasingly valuable.
Let me circle back to the specific role definitions, because I think it's helpful to have language for this. The Design Wine piece breaks down what an AI design engineer actually does into four areas. 1. Design system stewardship in a code-first context. 2. AI feature UX design and evaluation. 3. Prototype. 2. Production continuity, meaning the prototype isn't a throwaway, it evolves directly into the shipped product. And 4. AI tool orchestration.
That third one, prototype. To production continuity. That's a big shift from traditional practice. In the old model, designers made prototypes in Figma, developers rebuilt everything from scratch, and the prototype was basically a visual spec that got discarded. In this new model, the prototype might be an actual working app that then gets refined into production. The line between exploration and delivery blurs.
That's exactly what Daniel's describing with his voice typing app. He's been building it slowly over 6 months. It's not a sprint to launch. It's an ongoing process of refinement where the thing he's working on is always a working product, just at different stages of polish.
If someone listening wants to start making this micro pivot, what's the concrete first step? Beyond the general advice we've already given.
I'd say pick one tool and go deep. Daniel mentioned Claude Code and Gemini. Cursor is another one that's very popular. But don't try to learn everything at once. Pick the tool that aligns with the kind of thing you want to build and use it on a real project, not a toy, something you actually need.
I'd add, document what you're learning. not in a performative LinkedIn way, but for yourself. When the agent does something surprising, figure out why. When it fails, understand the failure mode. That reflective practice is what builds the judgment we've been talking about.
The other thing I'd say is, don't underestimate the value of your existing domain knowledge. Daniel knows the Israeli context. He knows the specific frustrations of Hebrew-English translation. He knows what would actually be useful. That domain knowledge is the thing the AI doesn't have. It's what makes his projects valuable rather than generic.
All right, we should land this. But before we get to practical takeaways, I believe it's time for Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
You're up.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact. The collective noun for a group of porcupines is a prickle.
What can listeners actually do with all of this? Let's get practical. Number one, if Daniel's trajectory resonates with you, start by inventorying what you already know, not what you wish you knew, what you actually know. Technical foundations, domain expertise, problems you understand deeply. That's your platform.
Number two, find a narrow problem you personally experience and build a solution using AI agents, not a tutorial project, something you'll actually use. The personal investment in the outcome is what keeps you engaged through the frustrating parts.
Number three, pick one AI coding tool and use it consistently. The specific tool matters less than the consistency. You're building intuition for how these systems behave, where they're reliable, where they're not. That intuition only comes from repeated use on real projects.
Number four, don't wait for a job title. The titles are emerging. AI design engineer, creative technologist, AI product designer. But the fastest way to claim one is to start doing the work. Build things, share them, let the work speak.
Number five, pay attention to the review paradox we discussed. As you rely more on AI output, protect the time and mental energy to actually understand what the agent produced. That understanding is your value. If you lose it, you're just a middleman between one AI and another.
The bigger picture here is that we're watching a fundamental restructuring of how software gets built. The traditional boundaries between design, product, and engineering are collapsing not because anyone decided they should, but because the tools make those boundaries economically inefficient. The people who thrive in this new environment are going to be the ones who can span those old categories.
Daniel's instinct about micropivots is exactly right. You don't need to abandon everything and start over. You just need to start blending these new capabilities into what you already do. Build one thing, learn one tool, solve one problem. The trajectory emerges from the doing, not from the planning.
One open question I'm left with. As this supervisor class becomes the norm, what happens to the craft traditions of software development? The deep knowledge of how compilers work, how browsers render, how databases optimize queries. Does that knowledge become a niche specialty, like knowing how to bind books by hand? Or does it remain essential infrastructure knowledge that the orchestrators need to have?
I suspect it becomes like knowing how a car engine works. Most drivers don't need to know, and they get around fine. But the best drivers, the ones who can handle edge cases and diagnose problems before they become disasters, they tend to understand what's happening under the hood. The orchestrator who knows what the agent is actually doing will always outperform the one who treats it as magic.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show happen. This has been My Weird Prompts, the podcast where a sloth and a donkey talk through the questions that don't fit neatly into career guides. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if this conversation sparked something for you, leave us a review wherever you listen. We read them, and they shape what we talk about next.
Until next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird thoughts, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird problems, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.